So we have spent the last better part of the last month or so celebrating the birth of Jesus. And even though we don't know the exact date, this date has been selected a week ago that we recognize, and it's good for us to be able to focus on the what I generally refer to as the significance of the event, and that is the incarnation, because that's what Jesus referenced in his communication with Pilate, in a sense, as well, because when he talked to Pilate, he said that the reason he was born and came to the earth was to testify to the truth. Well, in that statement is recognizing his birth and coming to earth. Not everybody would use that terminology, but he could, because he was the Son of God who left heaven's glory and came to earth. And then to testify of the truth, and we would certainly understand that that truth includes his substitutionary death for us. So there's really a lot wrapped up in that. It was a very condensed language, but it communicated quite a bit. And the continuing discussion with Pilate preceding Jesus' death gives more insight into what Pilate was thinking and what Jesus was thinking. And hopefully that can be instructive for our own thinking about the events as we're considering chapter 19 of the Gospel of John. So one of the things that we want to notice is coming right after in chapter 18, verse 38, where Pilate had indicated, came out to talked to the Jews and said that he found no fault in him. So that needs to be kept in mind as we come to the next text. And we see there's a contradiction between the treatment that Jesus received and the verdict that was recognized. Because after having said that he finds no fault in him, verse 1 of chapter 19 says, "Then Pilate took Jesus and scourged him." Does that make sense? He's innocent, so let's beat him. You know, that doesn't seem quite right. So we want to think about what was Pilate thinking in this. So let's take a moment and think about Pilate's treatment of Jesus. There's a good amount of unique material here compared to the synoptic Gospels. John deals more with the Roman impact, the Roman soldiers. So there are details of the Roman soldiers' abuse of Jesus, verses 1 through 5, and then Pilate's response to Jesus' claim to be the Son of God, verses 7 to 14. John also omitted some things that were included in the synoptics. He omitted Pilate's hand-washing ritual, Matthew 27:24, and the Jews taking responsibility for Jesus' death. "Let his blood be upon us and our children," they said, Matthew 27:25. He also did not mention the release of Barabbas specifically, though he alludes to it. And he doesn't address Jesus' most severe scourging, which would take place after as well, in anticipation of the crucifixion that was going to be taking place. And what we see here is that Pilate made another faulty calculation. It seems that Pilate had incorrectly hoped that if he had scourged Jesus, this would satisfy the Jews. This would be enough. If he just showed that he had given them some punishment, and that then they would be happy and they would just go home and it would just be fine. And perhaps he thought that this action would increase the popular support for Jesus from the crowds, as opposed to the chief priests. And then Pilate could just release him and be done with it. The reference would seem to indicate here that Jesus was scourged on this occasion not in order to be crucified, but to escape crucifixion. That's what this one seemed to be about, so that he could be released. Now, there were three common forms of flogging or scourging that the Romans would administer. There was the lightest of these, which was called fustigatio, and it was a light whipping for the casual disturber of the peace or whatever. So they would have a light one. Then there was a second one, which was flagellatio, And it was a more severe flogging that criminals would be given who were guilty of more serious crimes. And then there was the verberatio, or if it's supposed to be a softer T, verberatio. But that was the most severe flogging that would be given to those who would be sentenced to crucifixion, and they would be given that one. It seems that he would have been given at this point the first or the second of these floggings before his sentencing, but he received the third of these after his sentencing prior to his crucifixion, which the other Gospels reference, but John does not here. So it seems that Pilate was trying to evade the demands of the Jews by essentially providing a compensating punishment for Jesus, but it didn't work. It was ineffective. But this is part of the process that he began at this point. So looking at verses 2 and 3, we read, "And the soldiers twisted a crown of thorns and put it on his head, and they put on him a purple robe. Then they said, 'Hail, King of the Jews!' And they struck him with their hands." So then we have the soldiers' treatment of Jesus. Pilate is basically giving him over to the soldiers, and the soldiers then are going to be doing as they please, it seems. The Roman soldiers apparently took some pleasure in mocking the Jewish political plight. They may not have been so much antagonistic against Jesus per se, but they were perhaps because he was Jewish and they didn't particularly care for the Jewish people. The crown of thorns that is referenced here, that the Roman soldiers had placed on his head, probably came from the local date palm tree. And there were some Roman coins that pictured various emperors wearing a wreath of crowns, or it was a crown that would have been made of something like this, but it would have the thorns would have been turned the other way so that they would have been protruding out. But in this case, they would have been put the opposite way to protrude in to cause pain and sort of to be a mockery of the symbolism of the regal position. And some have suggested that perhaps John wanted his readers to connect these thorns with the symbol of the consequences of sin. And we certainly can see that picture there. Going back to Genesis 3:18, the garment that was put on Jesus to sort of present him in a sort of regal form was possibly a trooper's coat that they had put on him, something that they just had available, and to try to, you know, again provide an element of mockery here, and essentially putting down the Jews in the process. It may not have been directly focused on Jesus, but him being Jewish, they being Romans, that would have fit that time frame and the mentality that was present at the time. The Roman soldiers viewed Jesus as a pretender to the throne of Israel and basically despised him as another one of these individuals who rises up and tries to make a name for himself, as they had seen on many other occasions. So it wasn't like it was something new. So again, it's not necessarily directly toward Jesus, but he took the brunt of it, of their disposition. And of course, the Sanhedrin would have been happy that Jesus was ridiculed and beaten because they considered him to be a blasphemous individual who needed to be put in his place, and they wanted him eliminated because they saw that he was having too much of an influence on the people, and his influence was taking away from their influence, and they were not appreciative of that. When we see the picture that's communicated here of Jesus being presented as a king with a crown and with the apparel that he had on, we can see the irony of this situation because they were mocking. But we know he is, in fact, the King of Kings. And he was rejected by both the Romans, who were in political control, and by the Jews, who were the people to whom Jesus had directly and specifically come and was directly representing them as being one of them. And it's probably disturbing to us to see Jesus pronounced not guilty and then treated this way, because we would understand that to be the case. He was not guilty. He was the only person who ever lived who did not deserve to be treated this way. And yet he was. And so it makes the reality of our guilt for sin more obvious and perhaps more troubling to realize that he took what we should have received at every stage along this process. Then looking at verse 4, we read, Pilate then went out again and said to them, Behold, I am bringing him out to you. This is after he had been mistreated. Bring him out to you that you may know that I find no fault in him. He had already previously said that. He is saying it again. Been basically saying, look, I've punished him. He hasn't done anything that I can see is inherently wrong, and therefore we need to let him go. And he was hoping they would be happy because he had been flogged, essentially. The repeated verdict of Jesus' innocence. The soldiers' abuse of Jesus took place in the praetorium. This would have been inside, and we had seen that the Jews didn't want to go there, in there, because they didn't want to defile themselves in any way. So this took place away from the view of the people. They didn't see the actual flogging. They could only see the results of it, and they could see the attire that Jesus had been put into, and that may have set them off as well. But what was Pilate trying to do? He was trying to show that Jesus was no real threat to anyone. He said, look, I've already beaten him, put him in his place, making a mockery of him. You have nothing to worry about. But what we see here is that this was another clear indication of Jesus' innocence. Pilate did not find anything of a significant nature to be able to convict him of something in particular. And if you go back and look through the various texts, and I'll just allude to some of these, Judas had said, I have sinned and I have betrayed the innocent blood, when he realized what he had done, Matthew 27:4. Pilate declared, I find no fault in him. In this passage here, he indicated that Herod had found nothing worthy of death had been done by him, Luke 23:15. Pilate's wife urged, have nothing to do with this, with that just man, for I've suffered many things this day in a dream because of him, Matthew 27:19. The dying thief on the cross affirmed, we received the due reward of our deeds, but this man has done nothing amiss, Luke 23:41. The Roman centurion glorified God and said, certainly this was a righteous man, Luke 23:47. And then those that were with the centurion said, truly this was the Son of God. So there are a lot of passages throughout this, that this whole procedure, that indicate Jesus was innocent. He was not deserving of this. None of the charges that are being thrown out against him are legitimate. And so it was a frame job out of envy and ignorance, and the innocent one was set up, and the guilty went free in many different ways of thinking about that. We know that no one except Jesus was innocent, and we all know that everyone else is the guilty one. We have ultimate responsibility in that regard. And Jesus went through all of this because of our guilt. And so we also see here that there were both Jews and Gentiles that were involved in this injustice. And I think it's very intentional that it is communicated that way. And that may be part of why John went to extra lengths to indicate that the Romans were involved as well as the Jews. And when we see all of the whole process here, it really indicts all of us in the process. The concern caused by emphatic rejection, verses 5 and 6. Then Jesus came out wearing the crown of thorns and the purple robe, and Pilate said to them, "Behold the man." Therefore, when the chief priests and officers saw him, they cried out, saying, "Crucify him, crucify him." Pilate said to them, "You take him and crucify him, for I find no fault in him." Again, that is referenced. "I find no fault in him, and you take him." He's giving them over. Formal presentation and rejection. Pilate intended to present Jesus as a helpless, defeated man. He is no threat. You don't have to worry about him. And by this point, he probably was looking like a beaten and pathetic figure, as was intended. And Pilate was indicating that Jesus was in no position to be a rival king to Israel or to anyone else. He had already punished him enough. That's all he needs. You can just go home. This is all a waste of time. Pilate was just thinking, "I need to keep the peace. I want all of this to go away." And he had no idea how serious of a situation this was. And in fact, it was the most significant travesty of injustice in the history of the world. And we have to be reminded of that. And Pilate's concern was not to lose face and to just get it over with and get out of there, or get them out of there, whichever was possible. The response of the Jews became even more intense. The Jews were adamant about having Jesus crucified. And we need to keep in mind, this was not actually the same group that had hailed him as king during the triumphal entry. Now, there could have been one or two people who had happened to have been there, because there were some of the Pharisees that were present at the triumphal entry as well. But those folks were primarily Galileans who had followed him there, who were there for the celebration of the Passover season. But these here were the Jewish leaders and those who were following them, predominantly from Judea and Jerusalem, and they had a real vendetta against him. And then when Jesus was there, presented as sort of a kingly type of person because of the crown of thorns and the robe that he was wearing, the attire that he had on, that would have pushed the people over the edge, because they did not appreciate the implication that Jesus could even be considered that person, someone worthy of consideration. They thought the only treatment appropriate for him was crucifixion. He needed to be done away with. And even seeing him bloodied and bruised to whatever degree he was by this point, it only fueled their desire to put an end to him, to destroy him. And so they were seeking the ultimate punishment of crucifixion. And that was what it was understood to be. And that is interesting for us to think about. They wouldn't settle with, you know, giving him an injection to put him to sleep. They wanted a strong, harsh, cruel, the worst thing imaginable done to him, which is only fitting if we're coming from the realization that he was taking our sin on him. Then that makes sense. Otherwise, it does not make sense. And so the intensity of their distaste for him, we just have to try to recognize that is the general attitude of humanity against God that is being realized here. And then Pilate's reply sort of reflected perhaps some disgust with the Jewish leaders. It was really an expression of frustration and exasperation with them that he was experiencing at this point. They had brought Jesus to him for a decision. He had given it, and now they refused to accept it. His decision was he's not guilty. And they kept pressing and kept pressing. And Jesus knew that the Jews did not or could not crucify Jesus without his permission. And so he was really under pressure. And the pressure was intensifying. And what was he going to do? Was he going to hold fast to his decision that he's not guilty? Or is he going to give in? Looking at verses 7 through 9, the Jews answered him, "We have a law, and according to our law, he ought to die, because he made himself the Son of God." Therefore, when Pilate heard that saying, he was the more afraid, and went into the praetorium and said to Jesus, "Where are you from?" But Jesus gave him no answer. Well, you can see the pressure is intensifying. I mean, just imagine being in that situation and hearing that he's made himself the Son of God, regardless of what perspective he may have had, and he probably had some pagan views on God, but that's, again, something a little bit out of the ordinary. And he may have already recognized there's something out of the ordinary here. Recognition of divine identification. The Jews now shifted their strategy and their argument. Their objection to Jesus was both political and religious. They had been stressing the political implications of Jesus' claims to Pilate, that he was essentially an insurrectionist, he's a troublemaker, and he needs to be eliminated. But they were seeing that they weren't getting anywhere with that, so then they thought, well, we'll throw down something else here. So they were shifting to the religious claims that Jesus made. And they had made several indictments against Jesus, such as he was indicating that he was going to destroy the temple, Matthew 26, 61, that he was an evildoer, John 18, 30, that he was perverting the nation, Luke 23, 2, that he was forbidding to give tribute to Caesar, Luke 23, 2, that he was accused of stirring up all the people, Luke 23:5, he was accused of saying that he was the Christ, a king, Luke 23:2. He was now making himself the Son of God. Or they were accusing him of that, and he certainly was communicating that. And so they had several objections that they were giving, and so they were continuing to sort of add them up, accumulate them. But these accusations were very general at best and certainly misunderstood. The reference that they were noting here that Jesus was the Son of God, or that he was claiming to be the Son of God, to them was a clear case of blasphemy, because they were convinced that he was not, and that he was no one that should be given any consideration, and that he needed to be eliminated. And the penalty for blasphemy under the Mosaic law was death, Leviticus 24:16. And this had been a major issue in the previous trials when he was tried under Annas and Caiaphas in the Sanhedrin. And now John is basically indicating that the conviction among the Jews with regard to blasphemy was intensifying, and they were not going to let this go. So their rejection of Jesus was fully conscious, and it was a deliberate denial of all the evidence that they had seen already from the various miracles that he had done, from the things that he had said. They were certainly not accepting his deity, let alone him being even a political Messiah. This religious claim created further concern for Pilate. John hadn't really been very specific in terms of stating that Pilate was fearful to this point, but now it's quite obvious that there was an increasing fear, and for good reason. Part of it was because of his ability to maintain his own position. Was he going to get into trouble with Rome because of having let Barabbas go, who was a serious political problem? And he's got the issue of these people who are all but in a riot. Talk about insurrection. I mean, they were about ready to take him on. And I don't know how many Roman soldiers were present to be able to handle it. I assume there were quite a few because it was anticipated. This is Passover time. And having that many people there present at this time of day and all of that, you think this is not a very positive situation. And then there's an additional twist to the occasion that you might add in here as well. The Romans viewed certain people as demigods. They believed that their gods were superhumans, and Pilate may have understood Jesus' claim to being God's son as a claim to being one of these sort of demigod, superhuman creatures, a superhero. We would call him super, because they have superpowers. That's probably what they were what he may have been thinking. Of course, he hadn't read all the comic books that we have today. But if he had heard much about Jesus, he may have heard that Jesus had some of the powers that the Greeks and Romans attributed to some of these divine beings or perceived beings. So Pilate may now have begun to fear that Jesus might be in a position to take some revenge on him. And he may have already noted something about the poise that Jesus had, and it may have unnerved Pilate. So you start adding all of these things up, and Pilate was not in a very good place. And if Jesus really was some sort of supernatural being, which he had good reason to recognize he was, but he's right in the presence of him, Pilate didn't want to be responsible for mistreating him. And he may have thought that there could be some divine judgment that could come upon him, maybe not in the same sense of divine judgment that we might recognize, but nonetheless, as coming from his perspective. So Pilate's uneasy conscience is now further disturbed. And this reference to God explains why Pilate asked where he had come from. And he was on the right track, because he had come from God. But Jesus didn't answer him. And that only increased Pilate's uneasiness. Why are you not responding to me? Why don't you tell me? I mean, that's got to be difficult when he's already basically freaking out, as we would call it. Jesus had earlier refused to answer questions from Caiaphas, from Pilate, and from Herod. And he probably didn't respond to Pilate here because Pilate had already indicated that he wasn't particularly interested in the truth anyway. Pilate seemed to be only interested in what was personally expedient for him, again, preserving his own situation. And Pilate had shown little patience with Jesus' explanation of his otherworldly kingdom. My kingdom is not of this world. It was a spiritual, but had a physical implication as well. And he would hardly have been more receptive now that Jesus is talking about, or could be talking about, an otherworldly origin. So the decision that Pilate faced here was, does he release this innocent man or not? And the question of his origin wasn't really relevant in a sense. I mean, we would recognize that it is, but the issue was, if Jesus was innocent, he should be released. Now just imagine, if you were in Pilate's place at this time, what would you have done? How would you have dealt that? Would you have felt that pressure? I mean, I just can't imagine. That would be horrific. How would you deal with that? Except we know there's more to the equation. It wasn't just Pilate's decision. But yet it was, because he was totally accountable for what he did. And yet it was part of the total picture. But I think it's helpful for us to think about, if we had been there, would we have done any different? So, pressing on, the questions of authority and guilt. Then Pilate said to him, "Are you not speaking to me? Do you not know that I have power to crucify you and power to release you?" I have to interject here. Something just came to my mind. When we were living in Byron Center, Michigan, Susan was working for the grocery store, and she had someone come in who happened to be the bank president's wife. This was a small town, and whatever it was caused that happened, the lady said, "Do you not know that I'm the bank president's wife?" This kind of pictures that same thing. Do you not realize who I am? She's never forgotten it, and I haven't either. It was too good. I think Susan's response was, "So?" No, that's not it. Anyway, Jesus answered, "You could have no power at all against me unless it had been given you from above. Therefore, the one who delivered me to you has the greater sin." So, let's process this for a moment. The need for some perspective on authority. Pilate tried to motivate Jesus by appealing to his own authority. Pilate didn't appreciate Jesus' silence and likely the superior attitude that it implied. "Who are you to not speak to me?" kind of a thing. Consequently, Pilate essentially threatened him by reminding him of his authority, or his power, exousia is the word there, to take or to spare Jesus' life. He's basically saying, "Your life is in my hands, buddy. You better speak to me." And there may have been some element of sarcasm and resentment that was in this, plus some frustration that Pilate is communicating in the process here. And he may have almost been communicating, "I'm above the law here. I have total power to do whatever. Therefore," and I think it was meant to be manipulative to get him to respond to him. And so he now resorted to resting on his position rather than any serious rationale. Everything he had tried prior to this hadn't been working anyway. Jesus responded with an appeal to the ultimate authority. He reminded Pilate that there was a higher authority than his. And he pointed out that Pilate only had his authority because it had been given to him. Now the question here is, was Pilate thinking in terms of it was given to him by Caesar, by the Roman hierarchy? Was that all that he was thinking about? Or was he thinking there was something higher than that? Well, given the context, he should have been thinking, you know, in light of the question, "Where are you from?" and referencing the detail of him claiming to be the Son of God. And so he may have been only thinking in terms of the most immediate, but there was a higher authority yet that he needed to be thinking about. There's also an interpretive question here, and this has to do with who did Jesus have in mind when he spoke of the one who handed him over to Pilate? Now, one of the considerations is Judas Iscariot, because Judas is the one who betrayed him, but Judas didn't directly hand Jesus over to Pilate. It was the Jewish authorities who had done that. Judas had handed him over to the Jewish authorities. But others have indicated that probably was referring to Caiaphas, because he's the one that sent Jesus bound to Pilate. And that may very well be the case. And so both Pilate and Caiaphas were guilty of mistreating Jesus. But Caiaphas was guilty of a worse or a greater sin, since Pilate had received greater authority from God than Pilate had, because he had it in the context of a religious context, and therefore was receiving that authority directly from God. And God had given Caiaphas the authority to lead God's people as Israel's formal high priest at this time. And Pilate had only received his authority politically, but Caiaphas had it in a greater sense. So very possibly that's what was in view here, and the basic idea is he should have known better because of who he was, the high priest, someone who was knowledgeable in Scripture. He should have known better. Why would he have done that unless he had been either self-deceived or otherwise? And a combination of things is likely the case. And then looking at verses 12 and 13, from then on, Pilate sought to release him. But the Jews cried out, saying, "If you let this man go, you are not Caesar's friend. Whoever makes himself a king speaks against Caesar." When Pilate therefore heard that saying, he brought Jesus out and sat down in the judgment seat in a place that is called the pavement, but in Hebrew, Gabbatha. Again, another picture here that's communicated. There was manipulation by political pressure. The Jewish leaders finally played their trump card. You didn't know they had a trump card, right? He had one, or they had one. Jesus' reminder of the authority over Pilate moved the governor to press for Jesus' release. When he was hearing what he was hearing, he was feeling that pressure. He just wanted him to be gone. But the Jewish leaders reminded Pilate that anyone who set someone free who claimed to be a king would not receive Tiberius Caesar's approval. A friend recognition here. Oh, that's not like Facebook, by the way. It's a little more serious than that. They placed Pilate essentially on the horns of a dilemma. Whatever decision he would make at this point, he would get in trouble with Caesar. And so the solution to Pilate's problem would have been to do what is right, but he was too much into a self-preservation mode at this point, concern for himself and his position, that he was losing perspective. And his concern was he didn't want to lose his position as having the authority that he had in Israel at this time as the governor established by Rome. And he probably couldn't care less about his relationship with God, because that wasn't something that he would give consideration to. We understand that the designation friend of Caesar was originally a badge of honor that was frequently given to provincial governors, and it meant that the person who was so recognized was a loyal supporter of the emperor. And later, the title was an official designation of an intimate friend of the emperor. And at the time of Jesus' trial, it was probably more the latter, maybe a semi-technical term. But it was one that struck Pilate rather seriously. He didn't want to be accused of not being fully supportive and loyal to the emperor. And that, I guess we would say, scared the willies out of him. It's like, oh man, I am in trouble. They're going to tell on me. Well, the reality was that there had been bad reports about Pilate that had already gone to Rome. And so adding one more to that, and he would be perhaps in a much more serious place of losing his position, which was of concern to him. And so he did not want to be viewed as anything but a loyal subject of Caesar. And you know, if you think about it, in reality, the greatest threat to Rome was not Jesus. It was these Jews. They were the real problem. They should have been incarcerated. Pilate had found himself in a place of self-preservation. It was just doing whatever he can to keep himself from getting thrown out. At least that was what seemed to be his concern. And so it was this reference to being a friend of Caesar that put him sort of in the deciding place of, I've just got to get rid of this pressure. And then he basically turned Jesus over to them with the Roman soldiers carrying out the wishes of these Jewish leaders. So Pilate brought Jesus out again, and so the Jews could see him, and he took his, that is, Pilate took his seat for the formal sentencing, the judgment seat here, and it was a place where official verdicts would have been made in Roman culture. And so he is there. He is essentially going to wrap things up and put a bow on it and say, here he is. You can do with him what you want. It's over. So he was not doing what he should have done, but he was doing what he could do to potentially save face in that context and to get this pressure off his back. So he was put upon in that sense. And I think that also fits what Jesus had said earlier about who has the greater sin, who has the greater responsibility. It would have been the Jews. He came to his own knew him not. I think that fits that as well. So we have the capitulation to populist political pressure. Now it was the preparation day of the Passover week. Well, it doesn't say the week here, but it does in some of the other texts, and that's probably what is communicated. And about the sixth hour, and he said to the Jews, "Behold your king." The formal presentation of the kingship of Jesus. The chronological reference here to the Passover seems strategic on Jesus' part. Let me just make a quick notation here. There are differing views on the timing of the events of Passion Week, and it's a bit more complex than what I've got time to deal with, and so I'm going to sort of press on with dealing with the significance of what was going on here. Why did John make this chronological reference here? Apparently, he did so to encourage the reader to connect Jesus with the Passover lamb. And that would make good sense. Also, this reference helps to explain why the Jews wanted the body of Jesus removed from the cross and not stay on the cross, because it was a day of preparation, because the Sabbath that was coming was not only a Sabbath, but it was a high day because it fell during Passover week, and so it had an even greater emphasis. The time of day involved was early morning. And again, there are some technical questions as to the timing here. Mark wrote that the soldiers placed Jesus on the cross about the third hour. That would be 9 a.m., Mark 15:25. Here, John wrote that Pilate sentenced Jesus about the sixth hour. Well, you don't sentence somebody after you crucify him. So how do you put this order in place, the third hour versus the sixth hour? And the assumption is that John was using the Roman method of reckoning time, and that seems to be as workable a situation as possible that we want to consider. Before passing sentence on Jesus, Pilate presented him to the Jews as though this was a mock coronation ceremony. Behold your king. There's still an an element of what's the word I'm looking for? His frustration is coming out in this. He knew that the Jews did not acknowledge Caesar as their king, even though they had just said that they did. He knew better than that. But they said it in order to get what they wanted. And so the announcement that's made here is basically contempt, both for Jesus and for the Jews themselves. He's sort of sticking it to them, in a sense. Then looking at verses 15 and 16. But they cried out, "Away with him! Away with him! Crucify him!" Pilate said to them, "Shall I crucify your king?" The chief priests answered, "We have no king but Caesar." Then he delivered him to them to be crucified. Then they took Jesus and led him away. So the formal rejection of the kingship of Jesus. You know, we tend to celebrate Christmas, and when we do so, we are thinking about Jesus coming as the king. There's born to you this day the Savior, but also he's recognized as the coming king. And we recognize that. We see that. But the Jews of that day were not making that connection. They didn't accept that. They rejected it. So the rejection became more intense and formalized. They shouted their rejection. It was a demand that they were making. And they sort of hypocritically professed their allegiance to Caesar as their only king, which was nonsense, because they didn't want anything to do with Caesar. It was just a means of trying to manipulate the situation for their benefit to get what they wanted, what they thought they wanted at the time. And they didn't really know what they were doing ultimately, in a sense of having an appreciation for the fact that they were, in fact, killing their promised Messiah. And as a whole, the Jews still do not accept that. So this was, you know, continuing pressure that they were putting on Jesus. The Jewish hierarchy had accused Jesus of blasphemy, but now these individuals are actually the ones who are guilty of blasphemy because they are rejecting their king. That is blasphemous. And they obviously didn't recognize it at the time because they didn't accept that. This extreme, hostile, total rejection helps us understand why God turned from Israel temporarily to continue his dealings with humanity through the church. And, of course, Romans 9 and 11 remind us of that. On this occasion, they spoke in terms of cynical expectancy, but expressed the real truth. Their lives show that they gave no true allegiance to God. And that's something that we need to recognize, too, because sometimes under pressure, we may waver a bit in our allegiance as well. And they certainly did. The intensity of rejection produced the desired result. They finally got what they were looking for. They had to say many things that they didn't mean, or mean in the way they thought they meant. So they pushed Pilate into capitulation to crucify Jesus. And Pilate's action, the way he responds here, essentially is a sentence against Jesus. And it says, then he delivered him to them to be crucified. And by them, it evidently meant that Jesus handed the Jews over to the Roman soldiers to satisfy the demands of the Jews. And then ultimately, the Jewish leaders took responsibility for that, because they had said, upon our, that is, blood be upon us and our children. They were taking that on themselves. And then here again, we were reminded John omitted the reference to the more brutal and lethal form of scourging that Jesus was going to receive here, but the other Gospels do record that. So in his account of Jesus' civil trial, John stressed the divine kingship of Jesus and the Jewish rejection of him. So there's the presentation of the king and then the rejection. And the Gentile involvement here also has some significance because that includes all of us. It wasn't just the Jews. There were more involved in this, and they were representative of us. And so we are included in that. And when we think about it, from the human standpoint, the trial of Jesus was the greatest crime and tragedy in history. From the divine viewpoint, it was the fulfillment of prophecy and the accomplishment of the will of God and resulted in the provision of salvation for us. But we also need to keep in mind that the fact that God planned all of this did not absolve the participants of their responsibility. Acts 2:23 makes that very clear, that they were responsible for what they did. But the result was the provision of salvation for the world by this cruel sacrifice of the Son of God, the Messiah, that he went through in our place. And we can receive that provision by faith alone, in Christ alone. And we can be reminded that God routinely brings good from bad circumstances. He does that in our messed up lives all the time. We mess things up, and he takes what we've messed up, and he uses something from that for which we can be grateful. So our gratitude to him should never grow cold as we think about what has transpired for us. And even as we come to the end of this year, we face a new year before us, we have good reason to continue to be grateful for that provision.